Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
A lot of these brewers are trying to get as many local products as they can into their beer, whether it's local hops or barley that's grown in the state, whatever it might be, and local yeast is the next thing they're missing.
Matt Bachman has combined his scientific work with his love of brewing. We hear about his plan to harvest wild strains of yeast and make them available to home and craft brewers alike. The science behind why cows go moo with Harvest Public Media. Then we visit a rattlesnake roundup in Oklahoma. And our recipe features cracked wheat, also called bulgur. Daniel Orr gives us a basic lesson on cooking the stuff, then he combines it with a whole long list of ingredients for a delicious salad. Headlines with Mark Chilla.
The proposed Philadelphia soda tax has a new proponent, former New York City mayor and longtime public health advocate Michael Bloomberg. Earlier this year, Philly Mayor Jim Kenney proposed a tax of 3 cents per ounce of sugar-sweetened beverages to raise $400 million over the next 5 years. The money would go towards universal early childhood education funding and other community investments. Bloomberg tried to ban sodas larger than 16 ounces in New York City during his time as mayor, but the State Court of Appeals ruled the ban unconstitutional. Bloomberg pledged to back an $825,000 ad campaign through the nonprofit Philadelphians for a Fair Future, which supports Mayor Kenney's soda tax proposal. So far, the American Beverage Association has spent more than $2.6 million on their own ad campaign to stop the Philadelphia tax, calling it a grocery tax in television ads that portray the policy as a burden on low-income communities. Since 2008, 40 sugary drink taxes have been rejected around the country, including two proposals by former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter. The only exception is the Berkeley, California tax passed in 2014, to which Bloomberg committed over $600,000, the largest donor of that campaign. Three Philadelphia City Council members have come out against the tax, and the remaining 14 have yet to declare their vote. The council could vote on the tax as early as June. Using a high-tech RFID tracking system, South Korea has waged one of the most successful campaigns against food waste in the world. In 2013, the country implemented a system requiring residents to scan an ID card when using public trash cans. The receptacles weigh the amount of garbage that goes in, and a metered disposal fee goes to the user. Trash bags can be purchased for about $1 per 2.6-gallon bag, which also encourages sorting and waste reduction. The country's environment ministry says these measures have helped to reduce household food waste in Seoul by 30%. Workers at the factories producing our chicken face abuse on the job. Some are even denied bathroom breaks. That's according to a new report from an anti-poverty group. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has the details.
Oxfam America says the four largest chicken processors in the country, Pilgrim's Pride, Tyson Foods, Sanderson Farms, and Purdue, are under pressure to produce cheap chicken for hungry consumers. So much so that they're unwilling to let workers leave their stations to use the bathroom, forcing some employees to wear adult diapers to work. Minor Sinclair is with Oxfam America.
The most basic thing, like the right to go to bathroom, the right to relieve yourself, is being routinely denied by these companies for their workers on the line.
Representatives from both Tyson and Purdue questioned the validity of the study, and in comments included in Oxfam's report said employees have a number of options when reporting a workplace grievance. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
And perky meringues, fluffy pancakes, and proper pisco sours are no longer out of range for vegan cooks, thanks to a little trick that is taking the egg-free community by storm. Last year, a vegan in Indiana tried whipping the juice from a can of chickpeas in a blender. The result was a frothy foam that forms stiff peaks, much like its chicken-borne counterpart. He posted the results, which he calls aquafaba, to a Facebook group, and it has since kind of rocked the vegan world. Most commercial egg replacements have to be cooked, and kitchen hacks like baking soda and vinegar don't have the resilience to form peaks and meringues. A condiment company has recently introduced a new vegan mayonnaise that uses aquafaba, and the ingredient is now appearing on menus for trendy vegan pop-ups. A couple of other stories you should check out on our website. The FDA is taking a look at some of the words that pop up on our food labels. Terms like natural and healthy could become more regulated. We dig into why words like these are so confusing at eartheats.org.
And you can scroll through a list of other articles on our Twitter feed. Find us at Earth Eats. We find Mark Chilla right here every show. Thanks.
Glad to do it.
We all learned it as kids. Old MacDonald had a farm, and on that farm he had a cow that says moo. But why? Why do cows moo? We sent Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted to investigate.
What does a horse say?
That's my niece Betty. She's just about to turn 2, and she's been learning her animal sounds with my sister.
What does a chick say? What does a cow say? What does a cow say?
So she's getting there. But what does moo mean? Whenever I'm out in the field, I can tell many ranchers have a powerful connection with their cattle. They can almost understand them. But now researchers are figuring out exactly what cows are saying. Fortunately, I have the University of Missouri in my backyard, so I drove out to the beef research farm to meet cow geneticist Jared Decker. Today, he's checking in on dozens of cows that have been donated to the university.
So I'm definitely not an expert. I can't translate cow moos into English. But there are certain times when you can tell that the cattle are communicating with one another.
The cows mosey out of the trailers they arrived on and into their new outdoor pens on a damp spring morning. They'd spent the first part of their life on a nearby farm, but now they're constantly mooing as they mill about the feed stations at their new home.
And so they're talking to each other, trying to figure out the new environment.
It's like the high school cafeteria where everyone's trying to find their friends to sit with.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's kind of the same situation, right? You're in the classroom, you get up out of the classroom, you go to the cafeteria, you're now in a new place, you're trying to chat, find those friends, get back together so you can sit at the lunch table together. Same thing here. These cows were at their old farm. They were there with their buddies. We put them in trailers, moved them here. Now they're trying to find those buddies again.
Decker says that cows will also use moos to talk to us. Sometimes they're hungry, they need to be milked, or a mama cow needs help.
If a cow is mooing, maybe her baby calf is somewhere where it shouldn't be. It's on the other side of the fence, so that mama cow needs the farmer's help getting the calf back on the right side of the fence.
Cows have a one-word language. But researchers in England have actually shown that different moos mean different things. Researcher Monica Padilla de la Torre talked to me on Skype. Her team looked at communication between cows and their babies.
In cows, we could record 2 different types of contact calls.
Mama cows have one loud, higher-pitched moo.
They use this type of call to when the calves are out of sight. And low-frequency calls, which are used for cows when they are nearby their calves.
Hungry calves have their own moo. When they wanted milk but couldn't find their moms, they mooed like this. De La Torre says the calves' higher frequency moos and the older cows' lower frequency moos were individually distinctive, suggesting moms and babies can recognize each other's voices. Now, not to make it all about me, but there is a flip side to this. One of my biggest problems as a radio reporter, cows not mooing for my stories. Cattle geneticist Jared Decker says that's because happy cows don't need to moo.
It's when something's out of the ordinary that they need to moo, right? It's I'm hungry, farmer, come feed me. It's my baby's not near me, let me find my baby calf. It's
let's make a baby calf.
Yeah, let's make a baby calf.
So whether they're on the Missouri Research Farm or Old MacDonald's farm, cows use moos to communicate. My colleague's toddler, Ranger, is learning about Old MacDonald and his herd.
Moo, moo, am, I am, moo, moo.
Here a moo, there a moo. It turns out that moo actually means something specific.
E-I-I-O, yay!
Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
With the here and the
What is yeast? Matt Bachman says it's the simplest type of organism that's like a human cell. As a molecular and cellular biochemist, he's been working with these one-celled fungi in the lab for about 15 years.
So all of the same machinery that keeps us going is the same thing that keeps a yeast cell going. So you can use yeast to make a lot of things. So antibodies and antibiotics and things that are, you know, clinically used were developed in yeast a lot of times and produced in yeast. So you can do a lot with a tiny little organism.
Yeast is also that thing that turns that dark brown, woody-smelling tea brewers call wort into alcoholic beer. He's now bringing his scientific research to the beer community with his business Wild Pitch Yeast. As it is, brewers these days use just a few of the hundreds of thousands of varieties of yeast out there in nature. Bachman wants to expand the varieties of yeast brewers have access to and help make a truly local brew. And in this case, he says local could mean literally your backyard.
Commercial yeast is great. I mean, it's the gold standard. It's what everybody uses because it works consistently and reliably. It is expensive, though, especially for people that aren't on the West Coast, where for right now, that's where the big yeast labs are. So a brewery in Indiana might spend $600 to buy a quantity of yeast to make a big batch of beer, but the shipping on that yeast is $700. So there's a huge hit from just being, you know, geographically far from these places. The other thing is that most of the commercially available strains out there are all of European origin. These were things that, you know, maybe German immigrants brought with them when they started breweries in the U.S., or people that have traveled to Belgium and places like that just brought back with them. So if you really want to make an all-American beer, you need an all-American yeast.
A 35-year-old is an assistant professor at Indiana University. His interest in studying yeast started right around the time he fermented his first beverage, when he was in college in rural Pennsylvania. The raw apple cider he bought from an Amish farmer had yeast in it naturally, so making hard cider was pretty easy, he remembers. Then he got into homebrewing when he had more time on his hands in grad school, and he would just experiment. What would it taste like to throw a cup of blackberries in a wheat beer? And what about the different tastes of the different yeasts? He says the strain of yeast you put in a beer can have a significant influence on the taste. It can affect the alcohol content and the cloudiness of a beer, too. Since he was working in a yeast lab at the University of Pittsburgh, he had access to lots of different varieties.
So I've taken home lab yeast and used that to make beer with. And at one point, I'd created a strain that expressed a human kidney protein. And I figured, well, I might as well throw this into some beer. And, you know, the amount of human protein in that beer was incredibly infinitesimal. But we called it Soylent Stout and Cannibal Stout and all these things. It was actually really good.
You want to make a beer with the yeast from your kid's hair? Well, Matt can help you do that. Yeast is everywhere, he says, on this microphone, on tree bark, on the world's highest mountains. Having that spirit of experimentation, he started harvesting yeast from all over the place to see what beer brewing strains were out there.
We just take some kind of environmental sample. Again, pick your favorite weird object in your field of view, and we bring it back into the lab, and we've devised a special medium that selects for and enriches for yeasts and basically selects against everything else. So there's bacteria and filamentous fungus and all that stuff out there. And so through a series of just sort of commonplace microbiological techniques, we can go from a soil sample, for instance, to, you know, five or six pure strains in under a week. And then we can freeze those guys down. We can figure out what species they are using molecular techniques. We can start to brew with them, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out that it's very, very easy to find yeast that you can make beer with. I mean, we've found them everywhere, literally everywhere that we've looked. In just a few months, we gathered 300 strains, and we could have had 3,000 strains. We literally had to stop ourselves because the problem is the proof is in the brewing, right? You can run a bunch of lab tests and say this, that, and the other thing about them, but until you actually taste what they make, you can never say, oh, this is going to be a great IPA yeast or a great English ale yeast or whatever it is.
So that means there's a shelf in his lab with about 40 bottles of beer in the making. Fermentation takes 2 weeks, then carbonation takes another 2 weeks. So he's in the cycle of tasting new beers every 2 weeks. And his goal is to test out 250 different strains of yeast to see which works best with which styles of beer. He'll then catalog them on the Wild Pitch Yeast website with descriptions of the flavor profiles. And actually, Bachman says that's been the toughest part, developing his sense of smell and taste to write up a proper definition of the yeasts.
There's not a one-to-one correlation with where we collect the yeast and the flavors we get, though. An apple yeast doesn't necessarily give you aromatic and flavor notes of apple or fruit, and vice versa. If we have a soil sample, you're not going to end up necessarily with something that's got an earthy sort of flavor to it. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It's just luck of the draw. We've got one strain that's got this tremendous sort of fresh strawberry aroma and flavor, like not just the fruit itself, but you get a little bit of like the greenery with it. And it came from just a spontaneous fermentation that we did. So Mother Nature sprinkled that one in from who knows where. And that was a pleasant surprise.
Wild Pitch Yeast is also looking to crowdsource. They'll send you a kit to harvest your own. They'll process it in the lab, tell you what you need to know about the strains they find, and then they'll sell you enough yeast to make a 50-gallon batch of beer, if you like. Now, that's drinking local. Matt Bachman is an assistant professor in molecular and cellular biochemistry at Indiana University. The website is wildpitchyeast.com. Coming up.
This is kind of a version of tabbouleh, but we're going to add some tofu to it. So the recipe is bulgur wheat with cucumber, soy, sunflower seeds, and citrus.
Bulgur wheat, one of the new IT grains. Chef Daniel Orr cooks some up next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hi, I'm Annie Corrigan.
All right. Hello, Earth Eats.
In the kitchen at Farm Bloomington.
We are talking bulgur today, and also known as cracked wheat. It's nice because it doesn't take a whole lot of liquid to cook, a lot like couscous, a lot of the same way of cooking the bulgur. And what we do with the bulgur, put a pan on. I use to use a rouse, which is a wide-bottomed, low sided pan. So what I've done is I to about a cup of bulgur, I do about 2 tablespoons of olive oil, heat that, and we toast it until it just starts to brown, almost, you know, a few little specks of real caramelized, almost burnt, but that gives you a flavor in French, which is called ferré. And the French like that kind of toasty flavor. You'll see the real good French breads always look a little bit slightly burnt on the crusty parts. So ferré is purposely burnt. Okay, so that's a term that we don't really have in America too much. Then once it's got that color, then you top it with water, just enough water to cover the bulgur, and you turn off the heat and you let it sit on the stove, and it's going to absorb the water and get this kind of nutty texture. And you can see I'm kind of breaking it up now. You could use a fork, and it lightens it, just like you would do a rice. After you cook rice, you'd use a fork and you break it apart and make it very light.
And now it's great to use in salads, like Daniel's take on a tabbouleh, which we'll hear in just a bit. When you think of rattlesnakes, you probably think desert. But different species of rattlesnakes make their homes all over the country. While most of us know to steer clear of the rattling reptiles, hunters bring in thousands of snakes at traditional festivals known as rattlesnake roundups. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, it's Jacob McClellan, bringing us to a roundup in Oklahoma.
If there are any rattlesnakes in these rocky hills in northwestern Oklahoma, Ty Judd knows where to find them.
Just watch where you step, because like right now, they're starting to move away from the dens.
Judd and his friends have been rattlesnake hunting these gypsum hills for years, armed with long metal tongs, a plastic bucket, and a few simple rules.
Never put your hand on a side of a hill unless you've looked it over, because little snakes will coil up there and they can bite you in the hand.
We rumble down dirt paths, stopping at dens in the craggy rocks. Judd carefully peers into each hole, plucking out the venomous snakes one by one.
When he was like sucking in there, that's like when you jump, you know, you get down and get gathered up so you can jump real high. Well, that's kind of what he's doing. He's sucking in air to get as much power as he can, so when he strikes, he's got a good enough power to get you.
Rattlesnakes are common in deserts and dry scrubland, but you can also find them in plains and forests. Here in western Oklahoma, their dens are in holes in the rocky outcrops. That's the most common place to find them.
Well, that wind is sailing up that little frickin' deal right now.
David Wilson is Judd's dad. He says when the first homesteaders arrived in prairie towns like O'Keene, they had a mountain of rattlesnakes in the hills. Ranchers and farmers wanted to get rid of them, and so began a friendly competition.
They was killing them and seeing who could bring in the most. Well, then it went from who could bring in the biggest. Well, then it went from that, well, let's just see who can bring in the most and the biggest live rattlesnakes. And then it went from there.
That competition culminates in O'Keene's Rattlesnake Roundup, one of five such festivals each year in Oklahoma. The main attraction is the so-called Den of Death, where hundreds of mostly western diamondback rattlesnakes slither and rattle while handlers show off the snake's fangs and venom. Over 2,000 rattlesnakes went through the roundup this year, but none left alive. A buyer purchases the reptiles for their hides and meat.
These are the butcher snakes. These are what we're going to butcher. So let's get us a good one here.
Ty Judd cracks open a box full of rattlers at the fair's butcher shop in front of some curious onlookers, grabs one by the head, and puts it on the chopping block where it meets the business end of a hatchet. The snake is then hung and skinned. The meat gets fried. Rattlesnake roundups are not as common as they used to be, and a study found they hurt populations of the eastern diamondback rattlesnake in the southern United States. Some roundups in Georgia have stopped killing the animals. But wildlife diversity biologist Mark Howery with the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation doesn't think the western diamondback here is on the decline.
We're not seeing a contraction in their range. We're not seeing, you know, a strange or a differing size distribution brought into rattlesnake roundups, but we don't really know what the density of rattlesnakes is.
To some, rattlesnake roundups are inhumane because the snakes are killed as part of a show. The Center for Biological Diversity has called for an end to roundups. Cameron Seiler is the assistant curator of herpetology, or reptiles and amphibians, at the Sam Noble Museum in Norman, Oklahoma.
We would never see this behavior done on any other group of organism on the planet, definitely not in a public forum and celebrating kind of a mass killing of larger or vertebrate animals in general.
Seiler says roundups today don't protect farmers and livestock.
I feel like the roundups actually impose a greater risk to humans than just leaving them alone, because you're bringing hundreds of individuals of venomous snakes in close proximity to a large number of humans.
Today, rattlesnakes aren't nearly the threat they once were on the prairie. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says, on average, about 5 people die each year from snake bites. More die from lightning strikes and fireworks accidents. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob McClellan.
Pictures and videos and more audio stories like these at harvestpublicmedia.org. When Daniel Orr told me what his recipe was going to be today, and he mentioned bulgur as the centerpiece, I thought, you know, 3 years ago, that would have been quinoa. You may have started noticing recipes and dishes that feature other out-of-the-ordinary grains like amaranth, teff, and maybe farro. Professional kitchens like his are often ground zero for new trends in food, but he hasn't completely given up on quinoa yet. You can find plenty of recipes using quinoa at eartheats.org. But to our recipe, today we're starting with 3 to 4 cups of cooked bulgur in a mixing bowl, and to that toss in 1/4 cup of toasted sunflower seeds. You might have to take a few minutes to toast them yourself, but it is worth it.
What that does is it brings out the flavor by reducing the moisture in them and also toasting the essential oils. So walnuts, pecans, hazelnuts, sunflower seeds, sesame seeds, all those things we like to toast to make them more intense, and they also give it a better mouthfeel, so it'll make them crunchier. Okay, we're going to take a half of a English cucumber. The English cucumber you'll usually find in the grocery store wrapped in plastic. They're the long ones. We're going to use a half of one of those, and we're going to dice it up. All right, so now we're going to add 2 scallions. Just cut them thin, and I'm going to cut them a little bit on a bias. Today we're going to do the tofu. I'm using a firm tofu. Going to add that to our bowl. Okay, and this is where you can be creative. This is where you can add your different herbs. I'm going to use some of that Good Life basil. I'm going to use some fresh mint. We're going to throw a little bit of fennel tops. You could use dill. Okay, we're going to kind of roughly chop that. Now we're going to season that with some salt and pepper. And then the dressing, super, super simple. Olive oil and lemon juice. Just enough to moisten it.
This is your good olive oil, right?
Yeah, this is where you use your good olive oil. Good olive oils are for things that are going to be served either cold or warm and not really cooked and not with a whole lot of other flavors. If you're spending $16 for a quart of olive oil, you know, you want to get your money's worth and you want to taste that oil. So warm pastas, salads, drizzled over flatbread at the very end. And then the lesser quality olive oils or the blends are better for cooking and stewing and rubbing on roast chicken and that kind of thing. Okay, so half lemon, probably about 1/4 cup of olive oil. We're going to add a little lemon zest. Going to give it a toss. And I'm going to serve this up in a nice bowl. Let me give it a taste, make sure I seasoned it all right. So we have our bulgur wheat with cucumber, soy, sunflower seeds, and citrus. Say that 5 times fast.
A couple slices of star fruit make this dish really stunning. The photo and the recipe are both at eartheats.org, and that's where you can listen to our program on your own time. Make it even easier on yourself and subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. We've got a good group of folks here in the Earth Eats office: Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. And a special shout-out to 2 of our interns, Kate Griebel and Kale Wilk, both of whom are now off to conquer the world of journalism. Thanks for a great year, you two. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Good times today. Thanks for being with us. I'm Annie Corrigan.